next matter on our oral calendar today is Turner versus State of Minnesota. And counsel, as you're getting situated, I'll just remind you of our rules and let's make sure we have counsel for both sides here in the courtroom. Maybe we don't. Oh, we do.
Letting everybody out of the elevator.
Yeah, very good. Yes. Very courteous of you. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel. If you'd like to use that time for rebuttal, please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so that we can keep track of the who's making which argument in our audio recording of the proceedings. The timing restrictions are indicated in the middle podium. There's a clock. There's also a light. Please be mindful of your time limit. And speaking of platforms, you'll see that there are three different microphones. And you just have your choice. You can choose the microphone that's closest to you if you have any health concerns, or you may use the middle podium if you would like to use that if you don't have any concerns. Entirely up to you. Counsel for appellant, I'm not meaning to rush you. I know you just came into the courtroom. Whenever you're ready to proceed, when you're situated, you have the floor.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Eric Withall. I'm an attorney with the Appellate Public Defender's Office. I appear before this court today representing the appellant in this matter, Ricky Turner. Today we're asking this court to reverse and remand for the district court to vacate Mr. Turner's obligation to register as a predatory offender. And that is because his convictions for promoting the prostitution of an adult and his other conviction for racketeering do not arise out of the same set of circumstances as a dismissed predatory charge for sex trafficking of a minor. In identifying the same set of circumstances necessary to require registration, it's first important to identify what the conduct is for the criminal conviction and compare that to the conduct for the dismissed predatory charge. And looking at the racketeering conviction, because I think this is the only one that anyone's ever argued could arise out of the same set of circumstances, we need to first identify the racketeering offense by its statutory elements, and then second by the facts established at the plea hearing, the facts for the crime itself.
I'll interrupt you there. So I know that you argue that the facts at the plea hearing sort of are the body of facts that this court is confined to looking at and determining whether it was the same offense. Of course, the opposite argument is going to be made by the state. Is your argument about the body of facts being limited solely to what was stated at the guilty plea entirely based on this court's decision in Rosendahl, or do you have any other authority for that proposition?
I want to clarify that the argument I'm making that is in any way restricted to the plea transcripts only relates to the crime of conviction and identifying what the facts are that make Mr. Turner guilty of racketeering. So the crime of conviction is based on what the defendant comes into court and says that he did that made him guilty. Oftentimes, and I think this is recognized in Lopez and Berry, not being required to admit other facts that may have.
I'm looking at Berry. It sort of gives and takes away. When I look at the language, here's how the court concludes. The basic facts alleged in support of the kidnapping and false imprisonment offenses were Berry's scouting of the laundry, et cetera, et cetera. By contrast, the basic facts alleged in support of the offense of aiding an offender to avoid an arrest were Berry entering the car and driving her husband to Ohio. So there it seems as if the Supreme Court is not looking just at the allegations that were admitted to during the plea, but the facts alleged. I'm assuming that language maybe leapt off the page you too, and you're ready to show that that's really not what the court was doing. But if so, give it a run.
Look, necessarily, when we're looking at registration, the probable cause portion of the complaint is the document that identifies the charged conduct. And that's necessary because what's alleged in the probable cause portion and in the court's subsequent finding of probable cause is the only thing that lets the government require registration based on that probable cause finding alone. So the important takeaway, I think, from Berry and Lopez is the comparative analysis.
Right, but that's what I was referring to. Wasn't the court engaging in the comparative analysis when it says, well, here are the basic facts alleged, here are the other basic... This is at the conclusion. After the statement that I just read to you, the court then says, in sum, we hold that Berry is not subject to the predatory offender registration requirement because her culpable conduct occurred after yada, yada, yada. And in other words, the comparison seems to be, at least that part of the opinion, focused on the facts alleged.
I'm distinguishing between the allegations and the crime of conviction because it's those two different things that the courts compare in defining whether there's overlap in the circumstances. So necessarily the court is going to be looking at the probable cause portion of the complaint to identify the circumstances of the dismissed charge. I'm submitting that the conviction is never based on the complaint in any way of obtaining a conviction.
I'm just saying it looked like in that case, the court was comparing the facts, at least that part of the opinion. I think there's some other language that might help you out. But let me leave the law and look at the facts of this case. It seems to me your argument is based upon, if I understand it right, the fact that the enterprise conviction was based on this focus on multiple acts of prostitution by one person, not by multiple people of which the juvenile might have been incorporated. Am I correct that that's the focus?
That is correct.
And so here's my problem with that. What you quote in your brief is the very end of the plea colloquy where the focus is on BH. But many times before then, there are references over and over again that the enterprise is not about just the one woman, but multiple women. During the year 2016 through May 2016, you were involved in criminal activity. Yes, I was. What criminal activity were you involved in? Promoting prostitution. During this time frame, were you arrested? Were you holding yourself out as a pimp? Yes. During this time frame, would you agree that females, plural, that were working in this enterprise did both in-call and out-call? Yes. And then the females that worked for you, what did you refer to them as? Finesse bunnies. I mean, there's multiple. I mean, I could go on and on. And in the end, it's true, there's a reference to one person. And then the district court says, based upon presumably all of the admissions, not just the immediate one before then, the district court accepted your client's guilty plea. Am I correct that we ought to consider not just that language right before the court said I accept, but all of the admissions, including multiple females, of which obviously the juvenile would be one? You disabuse me of my presumption.
In identifying the crime of conviction, the court is allowed to look at the plea transcripts and look at Mr. Turner's testimony and identify what it is he admitted to that makes him guilty of racketeering. I have to push back, Your Honor, sure, on the use of the word enterprise to define the criminal conduct, because the enterprise is not some ongoing business that is illegal at its heart that defines the crime. The elements of racketeering is someone associated with an enterprise. An enterprise is actually defined in 609-902 as just a business or an association of people. That's the enterprise element, and that's it. It's the pattern of criminal conduct that makes someone guilty of racketeering. And a distinct feature, maybe the biggest point I want to make here today of racketeering, is that the pattern of criminal conduct is the accumulation of three entirely separate predicate crimes that are unified only in common scheme or plan or the criminal purpose. So we're looking at 609, 902, subdivision 2, subparts two and three, right, because subpart one, I think, says that it has to happen within 10 years or something like that, right? Necessarily, the crime of racketeering, because it's the pattern of criminal conduct is defined as three separate crimes different, occurring at different times and of different circumstances, but linked by their criminal objective, for lack of a better phrase. It's not every single thing that he ever could have done that was considered associated with pimping that makes him guilty of racketeering. It is the three or more identifiable criminal acts from the plea transcripts. And, you know, the prosecutor alludes, yeah, there's maybe other criminal acts that they could have identified as part of the racketeering.
I guess that's what I'm lost in. I thought when your client acknowledged that he was, to use his term, pimping multiple women, that was the enterprise. That was the, each one of those individual acts would constitute, the years that were presented, the dates that were presented, would constitute individual acts of, under racketeering. Is that not so? I guess I thought you were focusing on the one female and the admission about the one female as opposed to all the others as the distinguishing factor, making this not a racket, making it sort of excluding the juvenile because she wouldn't have been part of that one person's criminal conduct.
The enterprise is the association of individuals or his LLC. That satisfies the element for enterprise. The pattern of criminal conduct is the discrete and separate criminal acts. It must necessarily be discrete and separate criminal acts in order to form a pattern. And the plea transcripts only identifies, of course, generally, there's a bunch of women, there's a bunch of advertising that kind of goes out, referred to generally, to show the common scheme or plan that links these individual criminal acts. But the only criminal acts that are ever defined as a criminal act is the crime of promoting prostitution with respect to one individual, Brittany Harenza, and did so by several means. First, by advertising. Second, by providing a place, a house of prostitution where they did in-calls, providing transportation, you know, and like the car, for example, to get out to Washington County. And then another identifiable discrete criminal act is depositing the proceeds from prostitution in that bank account.
So if we do look at the enterprise, I know you don't want to talk about the enterprise, you want to focus on the predicate offenses, but if we do look at the enterprise itself, was there any admission made during the plea hearing that the enterprise included promoting prostitution of juveniles or involved juveniles in any way? Or is that essentially left unsaid?
It's not unsaid. It's expressly identified in the same transcripts as the plea, because plea and sentencing are in one, where Mr. Turner expressly repudiates the involvement of any juvenile females in the pattern of criminal conduct or the enterprise at all. So he talks about this is the only time he gets to allocute in the court. I guess it's kind of transitioned to sentencing, but it's the same transcripts, and he says, no, there are no juvenile females. He expressly says that he's not guilty of that. And I think that's important. You know, Judge Ross, I appreciated your dissent yesterday, that where somebody comes to court and says, I didn't do this thing, and that assertion of innocence goes unanswered, that it can't be included in the crime of conviction, that they're different things. So if he makes an assertion of innocence, then he's not guilty of that crime unless the court directly addresses that assertion of innocence, notwithstanding any of the other testimony.
Well, this is a slightly different context here, because this would be a dismissed count. He's accused of it. So at least with regard to the crime that's dismissed, we look at the allegations, not the admission, correct?
That is exactly correct. But in identifying the crime of conviction, you look at the defendant's testimony in the plea transcripts to identify what he did that made him guilty, and any repudiations of guilt are inconsistent with guilt. So if there's an allegation that his enterprise involves juvenile females and he expressly repudiates that and he's never subsequently rehabilitated, I think that's consistent with what Your Honor was also arguing in the dissent in
case. Well, that was with regard to a guilty plea, whether the plea was valid. In this case, there's no reason to talk. If I understand the overlap analysis of that the court's engaged in the cases we talked about with Lopez and others, there's a comparison between the crime of conviction, which is what you're arguing is what you admit to, and the allegations supporting the dismissed count, because there's no need for the prosecutor to get the defendant to admit to the claims that are being dismissed.
That's exactly right. So when we're identifying what the crime of conviction is here, my only point is that it necessarily doesn't involve juveniles. So in the same set of, right, because he repudiates that, and it's not, and it doesn't go addressed in any other way in the plea transcripts. So if we're identifying the crime as conviction as crimes not involving juveniles, and then we have an allegation that involves in juveniles, the big factor is people involved in the same set of circumstances test, and they don't involve the same people. So because the crime of racketeering doesn't involve juveniles, but the allegation does, they differ in people involved, they differ in same basic facts, not to mention time and place, and therefore there's no same set of circumstances.
The time and place, I think, would be tough for you because of the allegation, at least regarding the allegations. If, in fact, juveniles were involved, the admission that he makes is that he's promoting all of these females. He doesn't make a distinction. But I get your point. But I don't know that time and place. I think the individual is your strongest argument, not the time and place, if I understand the allegations and what he admitted to correctly.
If I may respond in
rebuttal.
You certainly
may. Of course you may.
My point is that in identifying what the same set of circumstances are, the fact that you have multiple crimes here unified by the same criminal objective, Lopez and Berry addressed that on all fours. That in Lopez, there's the attempt to collect on the drug debt is not, even though it is a shared common scheme or plan or criminal purpose that links the two separate crimes together, the drug sale and the subsequent kidnapping, that's too broad a reading of the same set of circumstances test. Or even Berry, which is even closer, right, where the purpose of aiding the offender after the fact is to take him away from the crime he had just committed less than a minute, inches away from the door dividing the two separate crimes. I think time and place are actually much stronger than Your Honor has suggested in this case, because it really has to be two of the same crime.
Well, let's take this up again in your rebuttal period so we don't go too far over. Thank you.
Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Counsel, my name is Nick Hajdukovic. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. The respondent is asking this court to affirm the denial of post-conviction relief. And I want to begin just by, I think, trying to illustrate the fundamental flaw in the appellant's argument here, that the appellant's argument really conflates the standards for evaluating the sufficiency of a guilty plea in terms of the facts admitted to with the requirements for predatory registration for a dismissed charge. There are two separate analyses. There's really very little overlap between the two, frankly. They are different tests altogether. The fact is that the appellant's denial that he was involved in trafficking a juvenile during his sentencing allocution is simply irrelevant to the analysis here. All that's needed, other than related circumstances between that part of the test, all that's needed is probable cause to support the charge. And there hasn't been any challenge by the appellant here to whether there was probable cause to support that charge.
Doesn't the case law suggest that there has to be a little more than just probable cause to support a charge that, you know, we actually have to give some teeth to the language in the statute arising out of the same set of circumstances, or else, you know, I mean, it could be so easily manipulated by the state. Oh,
I agree with you on that, Your Honor, and I'm not suggesting otherwise. My point is just that if the defendant denies that they did something in a dismissed charge, that simply doesn't affect the analysis, because the district court's job and then this court's job in reviewing that is not to really determine, as long as there's not a challenge to probable cause, is not to weigh the evidence in terms of did this person commit the dismissed charge, did they actually commit that offense. It's simply on the likelihood of whether they committed the charge that or the crime that was dismissed as part of a plea agreement. The that only has to meet the probable cause standard, and that's my point. And that there's been no challenge to whether the complaint alleged probable cause as to the sex trafficking of a minor. So I think that can be taken as a given that there is probable cause. The appellant's denial that he did it at his sentencing simply doesn't change that.
What are the comparatives? I was discussing earlier with Mr. Withall the Berry decisions. Looks like some language comparing the facts alleged to the in the conviction count and the facts alleged in the dismiss count. Is that the proper analysis, or do we look at the facts admitted to the in the conviction versus the facts alleged?
We look at the facts that are alleged in the complaint and whatever else the record may provide. And in this case, that really is just the complaint.
Because for both as to the conviction count and the dismissed count?
I'm talking about the dismissed count, I get. I do think it's both.
And well, here's the problem. That's why I said Barry kind of gives and takes away. It does include that language, but it also says this earlier. The factual basis in its analysis, the factual basis of Barry's guilty plea is consistent with the district court's determination, et cetera, in her factual basis, mm-hmm. Barry admitted to the following facts. None of these admissions suggest that Barry decided to help her husband, et cetera, et cetera. So there the focus is on what exactly was in the allocution, not what's in the allegations. And then later on, it talks about the facts alleged. So I'm trying to get a sense of what you think Barry was doing or what it's directing us to do. What do we compare?
And I agree that it does kind of give and take away at the same time. It is a little confusing in parts. But what I'd point the court to, I think, in Barry is footnote 9 from the majority opinion. Because I think there it gives the clearest cut indication that it is permissible to look at the facts alleged in the complaint. A few lines into that footnote, the court indicates, moreover, we have thoroughly reviewed the probable cause section of the complaint. It indicates nowhere in the complaint does it allege that Barry decided to help her husband flee before he committed the kidnapping and false imprisonment. And then it goes into what the probable cause section of the complaint does allege. In terms of Barry's involvement. So it seems that the Supreme Court was willing to look at both. I think what was admitted to in the plea allocution the plea colloquy as well as the
I don't know if that helps. I mean, the court's basically saying in that case, because of the outcome, well, what's in the allegations isn't enough. And I think it might be better to read, frankly, to say that a better reading to say, look, what was admitted to wasn't enough. And by the way, it wasn't even alleged. I think that's a fairer reading. I know that the court uses this language as comparing alleged versus alleged, but that I don't know if that's supported in other cases. That may be just an errant use of language by the Supreme Court.
I think it is, and I think the Lopez case is similarly somewhat confusing on the issue, because in the Lopez case, the court, it's at page 705 of the opinion, does state... does make reference to that there's no dispute about certain facts, I believe, alleged in the complaint as well as stated in the briefs, because I think there was some lack of clarity as to certain facts. And so, again, there's not a clear-cut statement there either way. But what I would submit is that if we are, in fact, if the court were to go down the road of saying that in order to determine the facts of conviction were limited to the plea, what's admitted in the plea, what I think the result of that would be is I think it would undermine what the Lopez court recognized was the legislative intent to not allow a person to get around registering based on how they plea bargain the case.
Let's assume we're limited, at least as regard to the conviction, not regarding the allegation of the dismissed count, but as to the count of conviction, we're limited to what was acknowledged. Just for the sake of your argument and my question, is there, why do you believe there's enough in the plea colloquy to support affirming?
Right. Well, so I think that goes to the questions you were asking, Your Honor, opposing counsel, about some of the things that the appellant did admit in terms of that there were multiple women whose prostitution he promoted, with the advertisements, with the in-calls, with all of this is a large-scale operation. About him using the profits for himself, all the things he admitted to involve multiple women. Now, there, as you indicated and as counsel indicated, there was only one particular woman with whom the prosecutor went into specifics, and as the court properly observed, that's because the prosecutor only needed to do that, and there was no need for the prosecutor to go into the allegations of trafficking of minors. But I do think that even just the plea colloquy admissions themselves show...
Well, not of minors. Of other women. I mean, if this is going to be overlap, if we're going to say that these are kind of the same, maybe it's enough that you have a bunch of adult women, but then part of the enterprise can include juveniles. In this case, it's a separate offense, and so they identify one juvenile and focus, and that's the dismissed count. But I'm trying to get a sense of what the specific denial in this case. There was an unusual specific denial. Like, I didn't, I'm not a monster, whatever the language is. Mm-hmm. I don't engage in this conduct with the juveniles. I'm adding to the language to make the point, I think, that the appellant's making. Why shouldn't that matter if we're focused on what is admitted to for the charge of what is convicted, not just the one that is dismissed?
Well, I think that what I would say is that is a problem if the court only relies on what's admitted. I have a hard time getting around that, but I think that that goes back to the point I made earlier about how the test, in terms of the weight of the evidence, is only a probable cause standard in terms of a dismissed offense. And again, I think if the court were
talking about not the allegation, let's assume we agree with you with regard to the dismissed offense.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it's as regard to the conviction. He's saying, this is what I did to support the conviction. And then there's this list of, there's a specific reference to this one, and there's general comments about females in the enterprise overall.
Well, I think that that creates a problem because, again, I think it would really undermine the legislative intent to not let people plea bargain around registrable offenses, in the sense that once that offense is charged, the registrable offense, if the person pleads guilty to anything arising from those circumstances, they are required to register. That would allow defense attorneys and prosecutors who may be sympathetic to them and judges who may be sympathetic to them, and frankly, this is a policy question for the legislature, too, but since we have to take as a given the legislature's determination of what registrable offenses are and when a person is required to register, allowing a person to simply deny that they committed the registrable offense and to say, well, that really defeats the ability of the registration requirement to be imposed, I think would eviscerate that legislative intent to not let people.
We have more than a denial. We have a charge that's been dismissed. Mm-hmm. We have a guilty plea transcript where the enterprise is discussed in great detail, as are the predicate offenses, and there's no mention of juveniles being a part of the enterprise or individuals who are being trafficked, and then we have the repudiation on top of that. So, I mean, isn't this a little different than the sort of parade of horribles example you list, where people could just plea bargain around charged offenses to avoid registration?
No, I mean, I don't think it does. I don't think so, because at the end of the day, if everybody's on board with some saying, this person's charged with a registrable offense, but I don't think they should have to register. All they have to do is deny that they committed the registrable offense and plead to something else, and we won't mention any facts about the registrable offense. That would defeat that legislative intent. And in this case, I don't want to get into the policy aspects of this, obviously, because that's a very controversial subject, and then that's another issue altogether. But we have to give effect to that, and I think we wouldn't be if we go down this route. But I also think that, moreover, there's just no legal basis that clearly requires the court to go down that road.
Can I ask you a big picture question? Another big picture question. So, the state's brief seems to, at least in the issue framing, suggest that this is an abuse of discretion review. Mr. Turner's brief says this is de novo review. Your brief highlights the fact that the parties were in agreement that this would be registered. I mean, what is the standard? Is it not de novo, whether the district court could legally impose the registration requirement? And that's the first part of my question. Second part is, why does it matter? Why should we care if it's de novo? Why should we care whether the parties had an agreement or the parties acknowledge, well, this is registrable?
So when I was looking at this, it occurred to me that there's always some confusion in my mind, because the case law says that an appellate review of a denial of post-conviction relief is an abuse of discretion. But then there's the case law from Berry and Lopez, which would seem to indicate a de novo review. And here I think, at the end of the day, the facts are undisputed. Well, what facts the court can consider may be in dispute. But assuming the court agrees with the state that, at least in part, the court can look to the complaint, those facts haven't been actually placed in any meaningful dispute. And
So you agree it's de novo review?
I do agree that it is, I think, de novo review, because it's a legal conclusion in the post-conviction realm.
So then do you also agree with my assumption that this reference to what the parties agreed to with regard to registration at the time, like, well, we all agree that you're going to have to register, mm-hmm. right? That doesn't matter, does it, for our review?
The reason I highlighted that in my brief, I agree that it doesn't bind the court in any way, certainly. The reason I highlighted it was because my point was that the Lopez and Berry decisions are, I think, trying to give us really a common sense way of looking at how to determine whether a dismissed charge arises out of the same set of circumstances as the charge to which a person pleads guilty. And my point was just that common sense approach here was, that the fact that the parties here agreed, I think the parties were looking at this through that common sense lens, that yes, this is a large-scale racketeering offense, the allegations of trafficking of a minor arise from that offense, and they're just taking the common sense view that I think Lopez and Berry ultimately impose. I wish there were clearer language in Lopez and Berry at certain points, to be sure. I think that would help everybody here today. But we're stuck with what we have. But what we have is a test. Then I think when that test is applied in the context of a racketeering case, that's very, very different from either Lopez or Berry, because we have much more discreet acts in Lopez and Berry. And at least according to the majority in Berry, you have sort of a line between the aiding and abetting kidnapping and false imprisonment that were dismissed on the one hand and the aiding an offender after the fact.
But Mr. Withall would say we have discrete acts here too. We have the predicate offenses, and you don't get to racketeering without the predicate offenses, and none of them involve juveniles.
Well, and I would disagree with the claim that none of them involve juveniles. There's probable cause to believe that a predicate act was the recruitment of BN, the juvenile, because the definition of sex trafficking includes...
But that wasn't charged, was it? Was it
yes.
charged as a predicate offense?
Well, the predicate offenses are not specifically alleged in the complaint. That is, the complaint doesn't specifically say X, Y, and Z are the predicate offenses. It lays out probable cause for this large-scale enterprise that operates over a lengthy period of time that involves numerous acts, but it doesn't specifically allege which predicate acts or what the predicate acts were, because I think any of them could have been had the case proceeded to trial. So I'd ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. If we're going to talk about why this charge for sex trafficking of a minor is even in the complaint, because I think Judge Gaeta has referenced, you know, the immense discretion that the states have to include or exclude at the charging stage offenses that would trigger the registration requirement, even if they were dismissed, and taking away a lot of that negotiation power. I raised the issue of the inclusion of that sex trafficking of a minor charge in the post-conviction petition, specifically on the basis that it was an improper venue or an improper jurisdiction to bring that charge in Washington County because all of the allegations involving the minor, at least according to the complaint, took place in Hennepin County. And the state responded not by saying that it was included as a predicate offense. The state, specifically on page 5 of their post-conviction memorandum, said that the reason they included the sex trafficking of a minor charge was under the aggregation subdivision of the prostitution statute and not that it was included as a possible predicate offense to racketeering. So that's on pages 5 and 6 of the state's post-conviction memorandum. And I think that kind of goes to the heart of the problem. The state does have a lot of discretion in how they charge these things, but even the predicate crimes, because they are necessarily discrete criminal acts unified only by their criminal objective, that unless the dismissed predatory charge was one of the predicate crimes, it was not, or rose out of the circumstances of one of the identified predicate crimes, then we are really applying a broad view of the same set of circumstances test to apply a could have been included as a predicate crime test.
It seems to go to your first prong, not the second one. If it could arise out of the same circumstances without being a predicate offense, correct? Do you
can arise out of the same set of circumstances. Again, because the test necessarily compares the crime of conviction with the dismissed charge, we're identifying the crime of conviction by its predicate crimes. Racketeering, the acts that make you guilty of one guilty of racketeering, are the three or more predicate crimes. The crimes that are identified as the basis for aggregating all of the offenses into the one greater offense of racketeering, right? You have greater offense and lesser offenses. The predicate crimes are lesser offenses, right?
So are you suggesting that it has to be a predicate offense? It seems like the two arguments are folded together. Other words, it can't be arising out of the same circumstances in a racketeering charge unless it's a predicate offense. Does that your argument take us there?
You absolutely have to register if a predicate crime, an identified predicate crime, is identified in the registration statute. That's not arising out of the same set of circumstances. That is for example, if one of the identified predicate crimes was sex trafficking as an adult that arose out of the same circumstances as sex trafficking a minor and they just dropped off the last element, right, you could have the same exact facts supporting the predicate offense, the same victim, and they just said, okay, well, we'll just prove that it was sex trafficking as an adult. That arises out of the same set of circumstances as a dismissed predatory charge just because it's differing in one element, right?
What if the racketeering enterprise is identified as, you know, the prostitution of both juvenile and adult women, and the predicate offenses only relate to adult women?
Well, the crime.
Would you agree that that would be registrable?
No, because the crime of conviction is defined by the predicate offenses. In order to compare the conviction to the dismissed charge, there needs to be an overlap between one of the predicate crimes and a dismissed charge. So, again, it's just a matter of whether they changed the statutory citation for one of the predicate offenses, but is really based on prostitution of a minor, or sex trafficking of a minor. It's to avoid manipulation of the charges to avoid the registration, I suppose. But here we're looking at what the actual conduct is supporting each and every one of the predicate crimes. And not a single one of them could be said to have included prostitution of a juvenile in fact or in statute.
Doesn't your argument depend on how broadly we define this overlap, that you know, how generally or specifically define it, prostitution of adults versus prostitution of females generally?
Prostitution of prostitution of females, but the crime of conviction is not prostitution of females generally. The convictions are prostitution of Brittany Harenza, and the predicate crimes are promoting the prostitution in three instances of Brittany Harenza. And the fact that the enterprise potentially involved, or
at least as I read the complaint, I don't see it focusing. The complaint doesn't focus on BH. The complaint talks, and then the plea colloquy refers to multiple women, not just BH, as the enterprise.
The crime of conviction is defined by the defendant's testimony at the plea hearing. And his testimony at the plea hearing only identifies one woman by name, by identification, that he promoted prostitution because that's what was necessary to identify the predicate crimes supporting the crime of racketeering. So to go and look at the complaint to fill in the gaps.
Not the complaint, but the plea colloquy where he's admitting that he's prostituting multiple, whole universe of females.
That's right. And none of the testimony at the plea hearing is sufficient to identify a single predicate act. I mean, you don't identify a person that he prostituted if you talk about multiple other females. You have to identify, even by initial, you prostituted person one, you prostituted person two, you prostituted person three. And the reason they don't go into it is for the sake of identifying just three predicate crimes. Because racketeering the enterprise is not just that he had, a habit of prostituting women. The crime, the conduct supporting the crime, is the pattern of criminal conduct, not the enterprise. The enterprise is the unifying principle. The common scheme or plan or shared criminal purpose is defined by the statute 609-902, subdivision 6, subparts 2 and 3. This is defining the criminal conduct for racketeering, not the enterprise, not the broader scheme. And common scheme or plan or related offenses, I know I see my time is up,
is
expressly rejected by Lopez and Berry, so we ask to reverse the registration obligation.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
And thank you to both counsel. Well argued. We appreciate your argument both in brief and today in the oral proceedings. We will take the matter under advisement. It is submitted. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you both.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Have a good afternoon. Your Honor.